Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We start the show today by talking with you about some of the legal issues that come up when you buy or sell a home. Kevin Trost back with us. Great to have him back. He's the founding attorney of Trost LLC in Madison. Kevin's got over 20 years' experience representing individuals, financial institutions, businesses, and insurers, and works throughout the state and federal court systems as well. Extensive experience is what I'm trying to tell you. Handling disputes arising from residential real estate transactions. And maybe you've had some problems developing that have developed for you over buying or selling a property. And maybe you have other questions relating to the whole process. I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Kevin Trost, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, it's nice to see you again, Larry.
Let's take a look at the current housing market. As a residential real estate attorney, how do you see the current housing market in Wisconsin? I imagine it varies a lot depending on where you are.
Yeah, I think it varies a lot depending upon where you are. But I think in general, the housing market is still pretty strong in favor of sellers. Now, a few years ago, you'd say the housing market was even stronger in favor of sellers. However, I think in the last couple years or so, things have backed off a little bit since the interest rates have gone up, which is kind of dampen demand a little bit.
Yeah.
It also, I think, depends upon what value of a house or what the price of the house is. In my experience, if you're looking at starter type of houses, which amazingly in these days we're talking $300,000, $400,000 for a starter house, if you're looking in those type of areas, I think the market is still pretty red hot. Once you start to go above that, the farther you go above that, I think you see kind of a lessening of the demand a little bit. But I think still overall in general, it's a seller's market.
Yeah. Well, for those on the higher end, what would it take to make housing more affordable? Lower interest rates, I assume?
Yeah, I think interest rates have a lot to do with it. I think when you saw interest rates several years ago decrease to, the unheard of 3% or so, you saw a flurry of activity in the real estate market. And now that we're up in the neighborhood of 6%, flurry of activity has backed off a little bit.
And I think back to when I was in my 20s, there was the interest rate was like 18% when you go and buy a house. So
absolutely.
6% sounds pretty good compared to that.
Yeah, for many years, 6% sounded just plain wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you deal with, you specialize in residential real estate law. What kinds of legal problems come up frequently for home buyers and sellers?
Yeah. A lot of my practice involves real estate disputes, often residential real estate disputes gone awry, where something has cropped up. Sometimes post-sale, where, a house sells and the buyer comes in and they start occupying the house. And for one reason or another, every time it rains, they get a river in their basement. And they kind of throw up their hands and say, well, this discipline isn't disclosed to us. And if this is happening with every rain, there's no way the seller didn't know about this because they lived here for 10 years.
Yeah, and it wasn't in any reporting.
Right. As a part of every residential real estate sale, with a few exceptions, the seller has to fill out what's called a real estate condition report, which is a statutorily mandated disclosure of whether a seller has knowledge of various problems and defects with the property. And it's a good list. It's probably about 50 different topics long. And that serves as a disclosure from the seller to the buyer or potential buyer of any potential problems that the seller knows about with the property.
And so that you, the owner knows about.
Right, and that's key. You know, an owner or a seller of a property can only disclose what they know about.
Yeah. Well, I had recent experience with that. I was selling my sister's home and for her, and I go down in the basement, and I look at the basement wall, and I thought the house was in pretty good shape, but the wall on one side was kind of bowing in, and I looked at it, and then I looked at that enormous tree that's right outside the house, and so I know about it. A professional didn't tell me about it, but I know about it. So under those circumstances, I thought it's got to be fixed, or it needs to be
at least looked at.
Looked at by somebody that knows what they did. And so we got somebody in who knew what they were doing, and, you know, a structural engineer type guy. And he said, well, you're going to have to do this and this. It'll cost this amount. And so I had that information for the person. I didn't do that work myself, but I had the information for the person who ultimately bought the house, knew what it was going to cost, and was still... went ahead and bought the house.
Yeah, I think you did the right thing there.
But if I hadn't, it wasn't anything that I wrote down, but I knew about it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And there's certain circumstances where somebody's not required when they're selling a house to fill out the real estate condition report. There's certain exceptions. For example, if you're selling grandma or grandpa's house, but grandma and grandpa have died, and you're the person who's coming in as the representative of the estate, the personal representative, and you're selling the house on behalf of the estate, there's exceptions for having to fill out the real estate condition report, because this person who's selling it has never occupied the property, doesn't really have any knowledge about the property.
Yeah.
But in most cases, when the seller is selling, there's a requirement to fill out that real estate condition report.
Let's say that the buyer and the seller agree, they sell, and as you say, then later the person says, well, wait a minute, he should have known about this. I'm taking him to court. Are there alternatives to filing lawsuits and going to court to resolve a dispute like that?
Well, absolutely. In a lot of situations, people don't just their first step usually isn't filing a lawsuit. Usually their first step is to sometimes, you know, without the help of attorney, they go back through the realtors who assisted with the transaction to see if something can get worked out or if there's some type of explanation for the problem. Sometimes people move on to a next step and they hire an attorney who sends a demand letter kind of laying out all the facts of what happened, and sometimes that leads to discussions that lead to a resolution. And usually after those two steps have been exhausted, then sometimes people make the decision to file a legal claim.
Yeah, and for sure, that at that point you need a real estate attorney, I would think, and maybe before?
Yeah, usually the earlier on, I think most real estate attorneys would say that earlier on they get involved, the smoother the experience will be.
That makes sense to me. In a seller's market, buyers are often, they will often make offers on homes they want the sellers to seriously consider. What should buyers do when they're competing with others who want that same property, like asking above the asking price, for example?
Right. If you have a competitive situation where it's a very popular house and you know that there are other people out there who want the property or will be interested in the property, the temptation is to try and make the number of contingencies that you're including in your offer very low or as low as possible. For example, there's one of the contingencies that you can check and request as a part of a sale and your offer is a home inspection, to have a private home inspector come after your offer is accepted and go through the house and point out any problems or defects that they observe so that you can negotiate that defect or problem with the seller to reach a resolution. And so if somebody believes they're in a highly competitive situation to get a house, they might not check that box. They might, forego the home inspection contingency. And you saw that a lot a few years ago when, you would have a house come on the market. It would come on a Thursday because for some reason houses seem to come on the real estate market on a Thursday. And then they have, all sorts of showings that first weekend. And then they got multiple offers that were asking price or above on that Monday morning. In those kind of situations a few years ago, a lot of people would bypass home inspections because they knew that just checking that box would make their offer less competitive, less inviting for a seller of a property to choose them.
Yeah. And I saw many homes that were listed as is.
That's another possibility. A seller could list their house as is, and which should really serve as kind of a warning or a caution sign to potential buyers that you probably want to really take a close look at this house.
Yeah, for sure. So what should sellers watch out for when they receive offers that are above their asking price? I mean, this looks great, but are there some issues that couldn't be in there?
Well, I mean, there's always possibilities. Check and see if the home inspection contingency is checked. Sometimes what you'll see is even if the home inspection contingency box is checked, there'll be kind of add-on language that the realtor will add that says, we're going to have a home inspection, but we will only come back to you and ask for money off of the sale to fix problems if the sum total of the cost to fix these problems is above a certain level, whether it's $2,000 or $5,000. And that kind of, I think a lot of that is geared to kind of make sellers comfortable that they're not going to be nickel and dimed as a result of a home inspection.
Yeah, that makes sense. How much should a seller be concerned, or should they be concerned at all, about how a buyer intends to finance?
Well, that's always another consideration. In most situations, you have buyers who come in who need financing, especially in these days where we're talking a starter house is $300,000 or $400,000. Most people come in and need financing, need a mortgage from a bank or a lender. But if you have, if a seller sees that the buyer is coming in with their offer and they're not making the offer contingent upon them being able to get financing, that should be a signal that the buyer probably has sufficient financial reserves to go forward with the sale, and you don't have to be concerned whether or not they're going to qualify for a mortgage or not.
And I would think that, this whole business about if you're going to buy a house, getting a pre-approval from the bank or someplace gives you the person who's owns the home, then they know, this is for sure going to be going through.
Right. That gives the seller additional assurance that, the buyer's hope of being able to finance the property isn't some type of pipe dream.
Yeah. Kevin Trost, our guest today, founding attorney for Trost LLC, extensive experience handling disputes arising from residential real estate transactions. I hope you'll join in too. Questions, comments, maybe you have an experience, good or bad, to share. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about buying and selling. Are you a buyer or a seller when it comes to the home that you have Maybe you've had some problems along those lines. Maybe you just have questions for our guest today, Kevin Trost, attorney of Trost LLC in Madison. It's great to have him back to talk with us. Again, questions 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Are there certain contingencies that buyers should consider not including in offers to purchase a particular home?
Well, that's hard to say. I would say in this environment, it's always behooves a buyer to include a home inspection contingency, just for their own kind of personal protection. Unless a buyer for some reason is a established, experienced contractor of their own, with their own level of experience, so that they would be comfortable inspecting a house by themselves. I would say the average person probably wants to have a home inspection.
I was thinking about, and I may have told this story on the air, if I have, forgive me, but a husband and wife had a house on Lake Mendota, and they decided to sell, changing life and so forth. So he spent a year before they were planning ahead. He spent a year remodeling their kitchen, and he did all the work himself. And then they sold the house in the first week, and then a few weeks later they went by to look at the house, and it was flat. The person had knocked the house down and was now building a much larger house, and he thought to himself, "I spent a whole year fixing up this kitchen," and that was the result. And actually, when I bought the house that I'm in now, the seller happened to be with me and was as we were going through the inspection and raving about the bathroom that he had redone himself. And all the while I'm thinking, this is going to go the minute I have the house. So that's some stuff like that happens.
It certainly does. If only that seller on Lake Mendota had known a year before exactly who he was selling it to.
Oh, boy.
Could have foregone the extensive renovation.
You know, Brock in Mayville has a question that kind of relates to all this, I think, in a way. Let's go there. Brock, hi.
Sure. Hey, how's it going today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I just wanted to make a comment. So I'm a realtor in Dodge County, and one of the things that a buyer can do to get an accepted offer really, much helpful is using what's called the Addendum AC Clause, which is called the Accelerator Clause. So in situations, and we're still running into it, not as much as we did like 3 years ago where there's 10 offers on the table, but still we run into properties that are really popular and there's multiple offers. The Addendum AC clause says basically that you'll pay whatever the number is, $2,500, $3,500, whatever your number is, more than the next guy up to a certain price. So rather than just shooting darts at a board and, saying I'll pay $200 or $290 or whatever the number is, you say I'll pay $2,500 more than anybody else up to $290. So just throwing that out there.
Yeah. Kevin?
Completely agree. I think you see that in a number of real estate sales where people will include that clause as a part of their offer, and that way the number that they're putting on the table with their offer isn't necessarily the final number, just in case there are other competing offers.
I had a situation where I was in a competition for a house, and basically the real estate agent said, I'm going to send you something. All three of you something, and you can either agree to it or not agree to it. And so I got something, and it was for a lot more money than I was willing to spend, so I didn't sign it. And then I find out later, about a year later, I'm talking to the person who actually bought it because I was friends with somebody a couple doors down. And I said, what'd you pay for it? And he gave me the price, and it was just the original asking price. And so I'm assuming that the realtor thought that I had more money. That this is my assumption. And wanted to see if I'd go way higher. And I thought, is that even legal? But I suppose it is.
Yeah. No, it's perfectly legal. I mean, assuming the seller agreed with their agent for taking that type of action and putting that out there.
Yeah. So I think the agent just thought I might be willing to go way high. And if not, this guy looks like somebody who will pay the asking. So that's how I lost that property in Door County. Oh, gosh. I kind of chuckled. Then I thought, gosh, that even legal? But why wouldn't it be legal? I guess you can do whatever you want when it comes to that. Here's a price I'm offering. Take it or leave it. Yeah?
See all sorts of crazy things sometimes.
Oh, man. Pete in Red Wing, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call all the way over here in Minnesota.
No problem.
Yeah, hey, we're new to WPR. We bounced over just for fun, and your show was the first one we caught. And now you've got two fans over here in Red Wing.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, it's a great topic. And it brings back a lot of memories of buying and selling property. But we stumbled onto a gorgeous old property in Red Wing up on one of the bluffs, built in 1912. And only two families had lived in this home prior to us since 1912, right? The last mm-hmm. couple have been here for 50 years. So it was a very emotional sale for them. There was never going to be a real estate sign in front of this home. And we got introduced to the owner, and I immediately recognized that he was emotional. He was very emotional about it. His mom grew up across the street and lived to 105. And so he told me, he goes, look, there's not going to be any contingencies, okay, plain and simple. You're welcome to get it inspected, and I would encourage you to do so. But I'm going to tell you right now, they're going to come up with 5,000 things that are wrong with this house. And the truth of the matter is you can move in tomorrow. And not do a thing. So he and I spent a couple hours and a six-pack of wine and Kugels, and he walked me through every nook and cranny of this entire home, 2,500 square feet on 2.5 acres. We walked the property and told me everything that hadn't been done and what to watch out for and made some suggestions. At the end of that, I was totally comfortable. We did the inspection. Sure enough, they came up with 5,000 things that were, you know, alarming. But we were ahead of that curve because we had invested the time with the owner, and we recognized that he wasn't going to sell this to somebody who was going to probably flip it. And so we said, we're in it to win it. We're here for a long time. My son was in school in Northfield. So that's just one other angle I wanted to throw into the mix, is if it's a similar situation and you can get access to the owner, invest that time in, you know, complimenting the owner on the house, on what they've done, the upgrades, the whatever the restoration in this case, and strike a relationship and, you know, get it inspected and make sure you understand what you're in for. And it all worked out. And they're thrilled that we own the home and we keep them posted on what we're doing. And they love to see that.
Oh, Pete, what a great story. Kevin?
Yeah, that sounds like a great experience. And you had a really good relationship, at least temporary relationship there with the owner and seller of the house, and they were very mindful of the issues that were present with the house. What I've experienced sometimes on occasion is that the longer somebody has owned the house, if you're looking at a real estate condition report and it's disclosing that they've been there 30, 40, 50 years, occasionally you'll encounter a seller who, you know, just doesn't have any clue of the problems with their house because they've been living there so long, you know, just continuing on in the same, in the same house for such a long time that they've been overlooking problems for so long that are things that are going to come to their mind when they're filling out a real estate condition report.
But I love the kind of the personal relationship with the person that works well.
Yes, absolutely.
I had another friend here, and here's just sort of tag on to what Pete was talking about. I have a good friend who, he and his wife were, you know, walking through a neighborhood, and they saw a house that they really liked, and it wasn't for sale, but they just knocked on the door and introduced themselves, and had a nice conversation with him, and he said at some point he said, look, I know you're not interested in selling the house now, but if you are interested, please let us know. Here's our information. And about a year and a half later, he gets a phone call from them and said, well, we haven't listed the house yet, but we're willing to sell if you're willing to buy, because they liked him.
Yeah. You see that sometimes, especially in popular neighborhoods. You have people that live in the neighborhood, but they want to change their house, but mm-hmm. they don't want to leave the neighborhood. And so they'll walk or drive around their neighborhood and identify some different houses that they would be interested in moving to, and then approach the owners of the house and say, hey, if you ever are interested in moving, here's our number. We just live in the neighborhood, but we'd like to stay in the neighborhood. Call us before you list the house.
Yeah. It worked well to everybody's benefit, I think, in those cases.
Yeah. Hey, Larry, before we delve into further conversations with people on the phone, just being a good attorney, should probably issue a disclaimer. None of these conversations constitute an attorney-client relationship, and the conversations are informational in nature and aren't really true legal advice, and that if people want legal advice, they should really talk to their own lawyer.
Yeah. I should have said something like that at the beginning, Kevin. Sorry.
That's all right.
That's good. I'm glad you brought that up. And Pete from Red Wing, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate your story there. Scott in Windsor is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. There's a series of TV ads on the station I watched recently, selling a product that apparently they claim protects you against a crime called title theft. Somehow or another, people are able to get hold of your title and transfer it to their name, and then all of a sudden you have additional mortgages taken out on it, and you're getting foreclosed on. Is this really a thing? With title insurance, it seems to me you should be protected, right?
Yeah, Kevin?
No, I've never personally encountered it with any of the cases I've had. I know what you're talking about because I've seen the same ads and I've heard the same stories. But what you said, I'm not sure exactly how often this comes up and how big of a thing it is. But for the fact that there's somebody out there advertising this type of service to kind of protect your title, I imagine it must happen
sometimes,
somewhere, perhaps not around in Wisconsin so much as, some other cities. But a lot of that title, my understanding is a lot of that, title switching would occur down at the Register of Deeds office, because they would be trying to file something with the Register of Deeds to, change the title to the property. And my understanding is a lot of the Register of Deeds offices, especially around here in Wisconsin, are pretty attuned to those type of issues and kind of watch out for, suspect filings.
What would, when you're selling a house, there's usually some, you've got to have the title taken care of before you sell a house. How does that all work?
Well, sure. Most real estate sales go through a title company, and the title company takes care of ordering a title report, which gives you a listing of all the different documents that have been recorded against the property, whether it's a mortgage or there's a lien or even just homeowners association documents. And you'll get a listing for both sides in the real estate transaction to review as a part of the sale. And you can go back and, if you have questions about one of the documents, you can look into it further, get an actual copy of the document and see what it says and interpret what it means and what effect it has. And then if it's something that needs to be dealt with as a part of the sale or before the sale can go through, it can be dealt with.
Vivian in Green Bay called, couldn't stay with us. Vivian strongly encourages homeowners to keep records of their home improvements. If the work is done by a reputable company, and I just had a skipping of my my computer screen here, so I've got it back now. I lost it for a second. If the work is done by reputable contractors, any buyer will appreciate knowing that information.
That is very true. One other thing along the same lines that comes up sometimes is homeowners, before they go to sell a property, will, you know, do their own home improvements. And depending upon the, you know, the extent or intensity of the home improvement, it may actually require a permit from your municipality. And I can tell you on the real estate condition report, there's a box that you would, that would ask the question about, did you have any work done to the property that might influence its value that was done without a permit? And if that's something that happened, that would be a box that a seller should check if they didn't go and get the municipal permit for their, you know, large kitchen renovation or their you know, the finishing of the basement. And the reason for that is a lot of times with municipal permits come municipal inspections. And so by getting the permit, the buyer is reassured to some extent that at least the work that was done by the seller, by who was owning the home, that somebody with some level of knowledge reviewed what was done and signed off on it.
Yeah, I looked at a house once. This is years back. I looked at a house once that was for sale, and the reason I didn't look much further was because there'd been quite a remodel and it had been done by the without a permit. I thought, no.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing you want is to buy a house where there was a huge renovation done without a permit, and suddenly you start turning on lights and the lights aren't working, and you start, you know, smelling your electric wires are starting to flame up.
You don't want that. Well, another reason, I think, to go along with Vivian's suggestion about keeping your records of what you've done is that in some cases, or probably many cases, folks buy a house for price A, but then the value of it goes up to price Z. And then you want to, but you want to sell because you want to go downgrade to a smaller house or something. Well, then there are tax implications if you can't produce information on what you've done to improve the house.
Yeah, there definitely can be.
I would, and that could be a serious tax.
That would be something that they would have to look into.
Because mostly any house I've ever bought, I'm always buying something that's been valued higher than what I paid for the house. But I can envision even myself. I'm glad I kept records on the work that was done on the house.
Yeah, and that's something buyers always appreciate anyway, is if you have kind of a folder of the invoices from work that you've had reputable home improvement contractors perform over the years. They can see what was done and who did it.
Yeah. Harry in Rock Falls has something for us. Harry, hi.
Hello. I am calling. I'm a retired professional land surveyor, so I'm not trying to drum up any business for myself here. But I highly recommend, and everyone who is, you know, investing as much money as a home costs, that they do have a professional land surveyor do a survey of the property. It's not necessarily often, but it's not uncommon that what you think you own is not what is there. You know, somebody might have been, you know, mowing a couple of feet over, or, you know, a fence line, you know, could be much different from the actual property line. So even if it's like, even if it's a $5,000 land survey, it's certainly worth it when you're spending $250,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, Harry, thank you. Yeah, it makes sense, Kevin.
Yeah, no, that's not a bad idea. I mean, my experience, just a survey of a land is probably going to be in the hundreds of dollars as opposed to the thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
But, you know, and sometimes, you know, if you're in the middle of a city and it's a newer neighborhood and the lots are pretty, you know, cookie cutter, you probably don't need a land survey. But when you're dealing with an older neighborhood where it might be harder to find those iron pipes that were originally put into the ground, it could be helpful to have a land survey as a part of your purchase of the property. At least then you know, if that tree that looks like you can't really tell if it's on your property or the neighbor's property, if that tree up and dies next year, you'll know whose responsibility it is to take it down.
And on the other hand, if I read a story not that long ago about a guy that did the survey of his property and found out that the neighbor had built a garage that went 2 feet into his property. So he called the guy and said, you got to move your... And, of course, lawsuits ensued.
They certainly can in those type of situations. I've seen that before. Somebody builds over the property line, and then people are raising questions of adverse possession. And there's a lot of requirements and hoops to jump through in order to have property be declared yours as a result of adverse possession. That being, you've adversely possessed somebody else's property for such a long period of time that it legally the court should declare it to be your property. And there's, like I said, there's a number of hoops to jump through in order to make that proof. And, you know, you're talking a long period of 20 years in order to establish adverse possession. But nevertheless, those type of issues lead to legal complications, lawsuits sometimes, and disagreements among landowners.
And it's your next-door neighbor. You've got to live next to. Oh, man. Kevin Trost, our guest today. We're talking about buying and selling a home with him. And you can call in. The number's 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us. I see we have some emails here. You can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about buying and selling a house on the show today with our guest today, Kevin Trost. At noon, Ryan Zenk, an attorney and a certified financial planner, will talk about writing wills and medical directives and things of that nature. But right now, it's buying and selling a house. And lots of callers online, lots of emails. Let's go to Brian in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, good afternoon, or still good morning, Larry and guests. I had a question for, I happen to live here in Madison. There's a lot of infill with property development sort of erupting in the residential neighborhood. So as a seller, house seller, do I need to disclose to a buyer, potential buyer, that I'm aware of the fact that, let's say, they're going to put a five-story apartment next to the ranch house? So that's a legal question, and I know the answer for the ethical side of that, so...
Yeah,
I'll turn that over to your guest, Larry. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Like you said, Brian, the ethical side would be yes. But there are always questions on a real estate condition report, the extent to which you have to disclose anything regarding the neighborhood, because the real estate condition report is geared and focused on the property that itself that is being sold. And so all these questions are, you know, geared toward, is there a problem with the roof? Is there a problem with the foundation? Do you know of any pests or rodent problems? Those type of things. There can't think of any questions that are on the current form that really ask about, do you know of any impending, development on the property next door? So that somebody filling out the real estate condition report, just answering those specific questions, and that's all they do, that might be something that doesn't come up, doesn't get disclosed.
And it's probably legal, but you could imagine that somebody might turn around and want to sue you for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in most situations, if there's something that you know about the house or about something significant about the, you know,
the neighborhood,
always from an ethical perspective, probably best to disclose it, because you never know what somebody, you know, obviously the person who's buying the house is going to learn about it sooner or later. And, you know, you'd rather have it disclosed rather than having the person learn about it later and then be sitting there pondering in their head, well, do I have a legal claim against them or not? And if somebody thinks they do and they decide to go down that rabbit hole of pursuing a legal claim, that's going to cost you thousands of dollars as well as cost the other person thousands of dollars. And that's something that could just have been probably, you know, taken care of right from the outset.
And then to kind of to go along with all this, Corrine emailed, she owns a property that required her to spend a lot of money to fix, including to heat two bedrooms. The lack of heat was not disclosed in the seller's report of the house problems. The seller said they were unaware of this, despite living in the home for 13 years. The rooms were unusable in winter.
That's strange. That's strange.
I would have taken the court on that one.
Yeah, that's probably one worth contacting a lawyer about.
Yeah, sounds like she didn't. She just went ahead and fixed it. But, yeah, I would have been really irritated, especially if people living in it for 13 years are going to know.
At some point in time, during one of those winters, you're going to wander into one of those rooms and think, gee, it's awfully cold in here.
Yeah,
I wonder why. And you're probably going to try and do some investigation to figure out why these two rooms are particularly cold every winter.
Rich in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. So we have a situation where we have four siblings owning the family home. Three are in agreement with selling it to one of the siblings, and the fourth one is rather holding up the show. And I was told by a lawyer that if he didn't want to sell or he had such a high price that prevented us from purchasing it, that a forced sale could occur. Have you had experience with that, or is there any alternative how we might approach this in a different manner other than paying a ransom note?
Yeah, no, a forced sale is a definite possibility when you have, you know, four owners and, you know, you have, like you said, one holdout who won't agree on what to do with the property. But really, you know, courts don't like to force sales. They'd rather have people come up with some kind of alternative or resolution themselves, because, you know, really a forced sale is kind of the harshest of remedies, because it's much akin to auctioning off a foreclosure property on the courthouse steps. And, you know, nobody really wants that because it's really not going to get the best price for the property. And so I think in a lot of situations like that, it'd probably be helpful if all four of the parties would agree to probably sit down with a mediator who could listen to the arguments of both sides and might have some influence over that one holdout person to help reach some kind of resolution for how to move forward.
Yeah, and the alternative to that could be three people never talk, or he never talks, the one person never talks to the siblings again, or vice versa. It's not going to be the rest of your life you're going to be dealing with that. So I like the mediator approach a lot. I mean, there should be some way to, you know, a professional mediator could handle this.
Yeah, professional mediators can be very influential and can be very good at listening to people and helping come up with a resolution, you know, short of a long, drawn-out court process.
Yeah. Brett and McFarland, we'll go to you next. Hi, Brett.
Off to 70 degrees up there. The problem is...
Brett, are you there? I guess...
Yes, I am. Sorry, Larry, I'm here. So I was in
getting a part to fix my heater, which seems to have gone out. But I was just on historic houses. I'm a carpenter and general contractor, and really encourage people to get the best building inspector, home inspector they can. And then, I don't know if you mentioned this, but then you get this list. You take it to a general contractor and get a quote, and that can reduce the price, you know, significantly. I did a 1849 farmhouse from a kind of infamous landlord, Ray Peterson, on Milwaukee Street, and was able to bring the price down and significantly. And because once you take that quote back to the seller, go and eyes open. But this had round cottonwood logs for floor joists that the bark was still on. So to level the floor, we had to strip that, shim it up. But, you know, go definitely work with this. Find a good general contractor. And it only took me 3 years to get it up to code. But
there you go. Well, is that good? That sounds like good advice.
That is good advice. And generally, the older the house is that you're looking to purchase, the you know, better off you'll be having gotten a home inspection.
Michael in Middleton emailed with a question about what to do when builders or contractors run out of money or file bankruptcy before the, you know, the work is finished, be it, you know, you're remodeling or something like that.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Apparently. That's definitely a problem.
On Michael's mind right now.
Definitely a problem. I mean, I think, you know, obviously from a practical perspective, if your house isn't done, and your general contractor just filed for bankruptcy, you need to find another general contractor who will finish out the project. And then as far as the you know, contractor that's going through bankruptcy, probably want to consult an attorney and also look at the balance of the finances to see if you've paid more money towards this project than what's already been incorporated into the house. And as a part of that, you want to check with all the subs that have been working on the house to make sure that they've gotten paid. Because if the general is filing bankruptcy, you probably stand a fair chance that of finding out that some of these subcontractors are sitting there with their hand out wanting to get paid as well.
And so you paid the contractor, and he didn't pay the subs, and now you're going to wind up paying twice.
Potentially. There's claims you can make, you know, with the bankruptcy court related to theft by contractor, where the general contractor has gotten more money from you than, you know, what's been incorporated into the house and paid out to subs.
And so when you're dealing with somebody, if you're having somebody do the work just in the last 30 seconds, I mean, how do you kind of ensure, or is there any way to ensure?
Well, you got to watch the lien waivers. And title companies, when they're dealing with a new construction house, are often very good at making sure that all the subcontractors have signed their lien waivers saying that they've gotten paid and they don't have any claims on the property. And so that is something that you need to pay attention to when you're dealing with a new construction house or, you know, a house that's having work done on it.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you so much. I mean, we've got some really good questions here yet from people that we're not going to be able to answer today, but maybe you'll come back and do it again with us sometime.
Absolutely, Larry.
Love to have you back. Kevin Trost, founding attorney of Trost LLC. That's spelled T-R-O-S-T, by the way. Trost LLC in Madison. And it's great to have him with us, and he will be back and we'll talk again. Up next, we'll talk to attorney Ryan Zank. He is an attorney and a certified financial planner. We'll talk about writing wills and medical directives. I've had a lot of experience myself in that recently, and I'll probably tell a few of my own personal stories as well. That coming up next, right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to things like wills and medical directives and planning for the inevitable, I guess is the way one way we could put it, with our guest, Ryan Zenk. Ryan's an attorney with the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, based in Brookfield. Ryan's an attorney and a certified financial planner, also CEO of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, and co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. As we talk with Ryan, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about maybe writing a will or setting up a trust or maybe covering the cost of nursing home care? You can join the conversation. Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Ryan Zenk, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. You're the managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, and the website for Elder Law Center says you and your colleagues are problem solvers. What kind of problems do you work to solve?
Well, it depends on the day, but generally, it's a big focus of our practice is families that have a situation with a loved one that has a long-term care need, and they're wondering how they can coordinate getting that individual good care that they're comfortable with, while not having to become entirely impoverished. You know, not having to lose all their assets, especially when there's a community spouse, you know, the husband or wife that's at home. So that's a big part of our practice. And then another significant part of our practice is what we would call traditional estate planning, wills, trust, powers of attorney. You mentioned advanced directives, that type of work.
I really want to get into pretty much all of that. You're also a financial planner. When's it valuable to turn to a financial planner?
Well, I think if you're planning on retiring, or you are retired, I mean, it certainly can be beneficial to get some advice. And there's a lot of different ways for folks to do that. Folks can hire someone who acts as a fiduciary, as we do. They can hire someone who's a broker. They can hire someone. A lot of places now, you can hire someone if you just want someone to advise hourly and just maybe once a year or every couple of years, sit down and take a look at your financial picture and if there's something that they would suggest. So there's a host of different ways. That industry is evolving significantly. So,
well, it's not uncommon for people to not get their financial and medical affairs in order before they die. Why does that happen? I think I've had that experience recently myself in one situation at least, and I understand the reason for it, but it may be different from the reason that most people have to fail to do the advanced planning.
Yeah, well, you're correct, Larry, that a significant portion of the population doesn't have things organized. And I've seen it, I've been doing this for 30-something years, so I've seen it with people that are very financially successful, have significant estates, and I've seen with people, you know, that don't have as much in terms of assets. But and I think there's a host of reasons. One thing is it's not something that people often want to necessarily focus on. They don't want to think about the fact that, you know, we're all mortal, and it's one death per person per lifetime. And it's something that, you know, you have to do, but some people will just put it off. It's procrastination, not wanting to deal with it. In some cases, it's people are don't think that they have options, I believe, or they don't understand what their options are, so they simply kind of ignore it and leave for someone else to deal with. But it's almost always much more expensive to not deal with it than to do something ahead of time, in terms of both time and expense for your loved ones.
Yeah. You're right about that. Amy in Holman has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Amy. Amy?
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling. I am 100% disabled veteran, but for general veterans or 100% disabled veterans in the state of Wisconsin, what do we have for, I believe we may have some sort of access to a free will?
Or what benefits, in somebody in like Amy's situation, what benefits would they have that might cover writing wills and that sort of thing?
Amy, I'm not familiar with a particular program for free wills for veterans, but there is the opportunity for anyone to work with some pro bono, both law firms. A lot of law firms will do pro bono work, and there's different community groups in Madison and Milwaukee anyway, where folks can get a simple will for free. So that's something that you can explore. I'm not familiar with something where the VA pays for wills, though. I haven't seen that. Doesn't mean it's not out there, but I have not seen that, Amy.
Yeah, there you go, Amy. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Sue and Cable emailed she's in her 80s, wants to sell her house and rent instead, essentially to get out from under the responsibilities of homeownership.
Sure.
Mowing the lawn and everything else. She understands there may be important implication should she need assisted living or nursing care in the future. She has what she thinks is good long-term care insurance. Are there other tax implications she should consider? So she'd be selling her house and moving to an apartment.
It depends on what the gain is on your house. As a single individual, you can sell your house, your principal residence, that is, and take up to $250,000 in gains tax-free. One thing to keep in mind, so that is the gain that you're taxed on when you sell your house is the difference between what you net on the sale and what your tax basis is. And if it's a situation where she was married and her husband owned the house, typically, depending on how they held it, but most often, she would have received what they call a step-up in basis when her husband died. So let's say they bought the house for $100,000, lived in it for 10 years, husband passed away, it's worth $200,000 at that time. Now it's worth $300,000. Her tax basis would be the $200,000, not the $100,000 she originally paid for it. So she could take that. She sells it for $300,000. That would be tax-free. In other words, the $200,000 basis, you can add $250,000 to that. If you're a married couple, you can add $500,000 to it, and it's tax-free.
All right. So those are the implications, Sue. Thank you very much for calling. And you can kind of do the math and figure it out for yourself there, I'm pretty sure. David in Red Granite, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm concerned with my property. My wife died 4 years ago, and at the time I did not put it into a trust for my three children. I want to know what the look back fee is as far as taxes and the like.
For gifting a house to your children?
Well, I'd like to put this into a trust.
Okay. Well, that gives us an opportunity to talk about this, David. Thank you for calling. Ryan, let's talk
about
this.
So I'm trying to understand, is the house still in the wife's name and your name, or has it been moved over into only your name?
I have three properties that are in my wife's and my name, although I do have the death certificates. And I have one property that I inherited 2 years ago, which is solely in my name.
Okay. So typically, what people will do, again, you're going to want to seek a local attorney because it depends on how you held it jointly with your wife and some other factors. But typically, when one spouse passes away and properties are owned jointly, you want to file paperwork with the Register of Deeds in the county in which the property is located, and you want to have your wife's name removed from the property so it's solely in your name. That would be the first step, typically. But again, confirm that with local counsel. And then if you want to put it in a trust or if you want to gift it to children, you can do that. A lot of people are confused on gifting. A lot of people think you can only gift $19,000 or whatever the annual exclusion, whatever that is. And if you go over that, there's tax. There's actually not gift tax. As of 2026, there's no gift tax until you get over $15 million, and that's in terms of a gift. So if you go over the annual exclusion, which is $19,000, that's per donor, per donee, per calendar year. If you go over that number, you're supposed to file a gift tax return form, but there's no actual tax owed unless you go over the $15 million. So most people do not have a gift tax issue. Now, again, you need to seek counsel on that. There can be some problems with if you're going to gift property to a child as opposed to putting it in a trust. When you gift an asset, depending on how you gift it, most often that beneficiary, whoever you give it to, they're going to receive it and they're going to take it with your tax basis in it. So if they sell it after you pass away, they're going to pay capital gains taxes on the difference between what your basis is and what they sell it for. Whereas if you have it in a trust and then it passes to them when you pass away, most of the time is done properly, they're going to receive what's called a step up in basis. So that beneficiary or beneficiaries can sell the property and not have to pay any capital gains tax on any appreciation that happened throughout your lifetime up through date of death. So there's a big difference for beneficiaries in terms of capital gains taxes.
Oh, and what if you have a will and in the will it says the house should be divided among the two or three or four, however many their children there are. Can you get that changed? Do you have to write a new will, or do you what happens there?
So if you pass it through a will, the beneficiaries will receive a step-up in basis. But I'm trying to understand your question, Larry. You get it changed for what purpose?
So you if it's in the will, you automatically get a step-up in basis? Is that I'm thinking about the taxes for the children.
Yes. I mean, generally. I don't want to make a blanket statement.
Sure,
the jury,
of course.
Yes, the vast majority of time, something passing through a the beneficiaries will receive a step up in basis. Absolutely. And they'll be able to sell the property and not pay any capital gains taxes on appreciation that happened through date of death. Now, if the beneficiary holds it for another 10 years and it appreciates after date of death, they're going to have to pay capital gains tax probably on that subsequent appreciation, but not on appreciation through date of death.
I got it. All right. And David and Red Granite, thank you very much for calling. Our guest today, Ryan Zank, founder and managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk wills, medical directives, and planning for the inevitable with Ryan Zank, who is managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, also founder and CEO of Family Wealth Advisors and co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. So it's great to have him with us. Again, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. And a quick note on Garden Talk, we'll be looking at new and emerging fruit and nut crops and with the author of a new garden book on tomorrow's Garden Talk. But right now, wills and medical directives and that sort of thing. And Christina in Glenwood has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a friend. She and her husband were married many, many years, 15, 20 years. They bought a house together. lived in it for many, many years. He passed away a year ago, and then she learned that her name is not on the deed. So what is the best way to handle this?
Well, I would recommend she sees an attorney who practices in that area. So, I mean, it's going to depend on what his estate plan said, you know, if he had one. So it may require, if the property was just in his name and he didn't have a transfer on death deed done, which is something you can do in Wisconsin if you want to pass a house without it going through probate. It's a simple thing that folks can do, which sometimes is suitable. But assuming that that was not done, he didn't do that, and he passed away and the house was in his name, it's going to pass through his estate. So it's going to depend on what his estate planning document said. If he didn't have any documents in place and he passed away owning the house without a beneficiary on it, it's going to pass based on what they call the laws of intestacy. In English, the law who gets what based on what the state thinks the hierarchy should be. And in Wisconsin, we're a marital property state, so typically a spouse is the beneficiary. If there were children from a prior marriage, it can be different. They can be a beneficiary as well as surviving spouse. So there's different things that come in there. But the bottom line is, I mean, what you should do is set up an appointment, and you could probably do it at no charge for complimentary consultation. A lot of state plan attorneys will do that. And take in a copy of your deed or the deed to the property and any estate planning documents that your husband had and go from there.
Yeah. Christina, thanks for calling. Well, this whole business, Beth in Cottage Grove kind of brings it up in some ways. She's asking a question about simple wills and estate plans. Why would you choose one over the other? Beth and her husband want everything they own to go to their daughter.
So there's a number of different options in Wisconsin in terms of how one can pass assets when they pass away. And I guess like a lot of choices in life, there's advantages and disadvantages of the various options. Some things like a trust are a little bit more complex and may cost more money up front because there's more drafting for the attorney, whereas something like a will may cost significantly less initially, but there can be a significant cost at the end because if it passes through the will, it's going to pass through the probate process, which takes some time, and it takes about 10 to 13 months depending on the county, Wisconsin, that the person's in. And it costs some money. There's court costs and attorney's fees that could potentially otherwise be avoided. Wisconsin also has some other choices, other options for folks. Married couples can sign a marital property agreement. If they put the right language in it, they can have everything pass and bypass probate. Another thing they can do is people can put beneficiaries on assets. As I said earlier, you can even put a beneficiary on your real estate now in Wisconsin. And if it passes based on beneficiary designation, it's not going to have to go through the probate process. And usually putting the beneficiary on it costs little to nothing. So there are a number of different options. And I think what's smart is to go meet with someone who focuses in that area and explain your situation. And there's a lot of, you know, different variables that come in doing an estate plan. Sometimes simple works great. Sometimes people are worried that, hey, if I just leave everything to my daughter, what happens if my daughter goes through a divorce 5 years after we're dead and gone? Is that money going to go to the outlaw, used to be the in-law? How do I protect against assets going to a creditor of my child or a divorcing spouse or something? And the answer is, well, you can do that, but you have to think it through. You can't simply, if that's a goal, that's a concern, you can't simply pass the asset to the child and say, hey, I wish for the best. You can actually give your child an airbag, if you would, to protect it, if that's important to you. So there's a host of different factors. Sometimes people have children with special needs, and they don't want their children to lose any benefits they'd be eligible for. So you want to leave it to that child in such a way that they still qualify for available benefits, but what you leave them can also benefit them and doesn't render them ineligible. is an accountable asset, if you would.
That makes really good sense. Owen in Cornucopia emailed to ask if there's any way other than dying that you can get rid of a timeshare in Florida.
I'll tell you, Larry, I probably get offered about 50 timeshares a year.
Yep.
Yeah, that's actually a good question. The answer is yes. There actually are attorneys. I don't do that, but we actually have an attorney in our firm that has helped a number of clients get rid of timeshares. So yes, there are folks out there that will assist in that regard. I've heard commercials from some of them, so I think it's something you could probably search online and find someone. So there probably are opportunities for you to get rid of a timeshare. That's a common issue, quite frankly.
I wanted to bring up medical power of attorney, and we've had a question on this. It can be granted to an adult child or a friend or anybody, I think, to make health care decisions for a surviving parent, or maybe it's a brother or sister or whatever. And this, how important is this role? And I guess the question is, you see, if you go online, you can find, you can do this for free, and here's a form. And go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, that's right, Larry. Actually, the Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney, and to the best of my knowledge, in most states anyway, the Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney is available online, and it's a good document. So sometimes the online documents aren't necessarily the best, but the Wisconsin Medical Power of Attorney is available online. People can print that out, fill in the blanks, and you need two witnesses. It doesn't need to be notarized. And it's a good document. So absolutely, you get that free. You can also get medical powers of attorney at most hospitals in Wisconsin and most medical care providers. So that is a very important form for people to have. And you're correct. You can name anyone who's age majority to make medical decisions if you're unable to do so. And Wisconsin statutes require that two doctors, two licensed medical doctors, sign off that the person is unable to make, not competent to make their own medical decisions. And then your agent's authority is activated, if you would. It springs to life. Now, in addition to a medical power of attorney, I strongly recommend that people also complete a HIPAA authorization. And HIPAA is a federal law. It has to do with medical privacy and some other things. But under the HIPAA document, which you probably can get that, I know you can get it online as well. It's not a state document, a federal. But you authorize people to be able to talk to your medical care providers, or say sit in the room when a doctor is talking about your prognosis or whatever. So it's important to also fill in a HIPAA form. Folks might want a particular child to be the agent under medical power of attorney, but they want all their children to be able to be present in the room. So you would want to complete the HIPAA form as well.
Okay, and on the medical, if you just type in Wisconsin medical power of attorney, that'll pop up, or where would you go to get the official one?
You can go to DHS, Department of Health Services for Wisconsin, and you can locate under that. But I think you're right, Larry. I think if you just type in Wisconsin medical power of attorney, it will come up. And it is important. It might seem like it's not important, but there's actually a cover sheet that comes with it. Make sure you print out the cover sheet and have that attached also. It should say something like notice to person making this document or something like that on the front. So there's a page that seems like it's not important, but it's actually in the statutes. It's part of it. So just make sure you print out the cover sheet as well as the pages that you actually have to fill in, names, et cetera.
Okay. And let's go to Sam in Madison next. Hi, Sam.
Howdy. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I got a question. Mentioned buying some land, and I'd expect to put it into a trust soon after. I'm wondering if there's a strategic benefit to buying first and then putting it into a trust, or asking if the land would be put into a trust before purchasing it.
Did you say putting it into a trust before you purchase it?
Yes. I'm wondering if there's a strategic benefit to having it be in a trust before.
I'm not sure how that would play out, how you'd put it in before, because you can't obviously put it in because you don't own it. So you typically would put it in afterwards. So with a trust, if you're going to finance the purchase, most financial institutions will want you to have it in your name when you purchase, partly because they want to sell that loan on the secondary market. So you would purchase it, if you're financing it, you'd purchase it, the lender would put a lien on the property, of course you'd sign a mortgage, and then you'd transfer it to your trust. So that's most often. Now, if you're not financing it, you're buying it with cash, you could put it in the trust right off the bat. In other words, you could take title, you could tell the seller that you want the deed to be made out, not to you personally, but to your trust.
Oh, so that's kind of a way. So it gets done right at the time of sale.
Correct. That, yeah. You know, most people don't buy properties with cash. Most people finance them. And typically when you finance, the financial institution will want it to be in the individual's name. That's not so much from a legal, it's more from a practical standpoint. They want to pool that mortgage with others and sell them on the secondary market. And so they want it, the mortgage they're selling, to show that it was in an individual's name. So you'd buy it in your name, you'd get a deed from the seller to you personally, and you'd turn around, you know, the next day or whatever and transfer it over to your trust.
All right, Sam, there you go. Thank you so much. Let's turn to Glenn in Merrill next. Hi, Glenn.
In an individual's name, so you buy it in your name.
Glenn, are you there?
To you personally.
Oh, he must have been not paying attention. Glenn, are you finally with us?
Thank you so much. Let's turn to Glenn in Merrill.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thanks for taking my call. My question actually kind of twofold about a trust. What's the difference between an irrevocable trust and a non-irrevocable trust? Which one guarantees my house for my children to have if I go into a nursing home?
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer that in this conversation completely for you, because there's a lot there, quite frankly. But I'll try to give you a 30,000-foot overview. So, as the name implies, in an irrevocable trust, something about the trust has to be irrevocable. Whereas in a revocable trust, typically whoever set the trust up, there's different lawyer words for the people who set them up, trust maker, grantor, settlor. Typically the person who set it up can change it, can take anything out of the trust anytime they want. And usually for example, for tax purposes, while that individual who set the trust up is alive, the trust is largely ignored. In other words, it doesn't have to file a tax return. On an irrevocable trust, There's different types of irrevocable trusts. There are trusts that are irrevocable trusts that have their own tax ID number, and there are irrevocable trusts that are treated like a revocable trust in that they use the Social Security number of the person who set it up. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both those. It's complicated, but there is the opportunity to go either way on an irrevocable trust. So, in a revocable trust, and this is a common misconception I think that people have, at least we see it a lot, where people think that they set up a revocable trust and they put their property in it and they think it's protected from a nursing home situation. It's not. It definitely is not. Whereas if the property's in an irrevocable trust, it may be protected. In other words, it may be that it's not a countable asset if someone has a long-term care situation. It depends on the trust, quite frankly, how it was set up. But you're going to want to speak to an attorney that specializes in that area, and you're going to want to specifically let them know that the goal is protecting that property if there's a long-term care situation. And so if you want to protect it from a long-term care situation, you're probably going to have to use an irrevocable trust. But there's significant variations in irrevocable trust, so you have to be careful. One thing in particular you want to be careful with an irrevocable trust is making sure that the beneficiaries receive a step up in basis on the property if it's an asset that can appreciate like real estate, and making sure the beneficiaries don't have to pay capital gains taxes they could have otherwise avoided. So there are ways to set up irrevocable trusts so the beneficiaries receive a step up in basis. Probably the majority of them do not provide that benefit, but there are methods of doing that.
Yeah. I also was understanding when people try to do that, there's a time period. You can't say, I'm setting up an irrevocable trust today and then tomorrow and get that set up and then tomorrow I'm going into a nursing home.
Yes, you're correct, Larry. So Wisconsin has a look-back period. There's a five-year look-back, and it's important to understand what the look-back is. That doesn't mean – some people, I think if I gave assets away within 5 years of when I go in a nursing home, I can't qualify for Medicaid until 5 years has passed. And that isn't necessarily the case. It can be, but it isn't necessarily. So the look-back period is 5 years. It's always 5 years. And look-back period is this. When someone applies for Medicaid or family care or IRS, there's different Medicaid programs out there. But when someone applies for Medicaid because they have a long-term care situation, one of the first questions on the application is, have you gifted assets in the last 5 years? That's a yes or no question. If you answer yes to that question, then the state of Wisconsin gives you a formula and says, okay, you're ineligible to get Medicaid because you intentionally impoverished yourself. It's called, the lawyer word is a divestment. You made a divestment. And I don't want to get too much into the minutia here, but roughly the current formula is, and this changes annually, by the way, the current formula is roughly for every $10,700 that you gifted, you are denied Medicaid for 1 month. And that doesn't start at the date that you did the gift. It starts at the date you apply for Medicaid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if 5 years or more has gone by and you apply for Medicaid, you can answer no to the question, have you made any gifts? And then that formula never comes into play, right? But if you answer, yes, I made a gift, then the formula applies. So a mistake someone could make is, let's say four and a half years have gone by since you made a gift of $200,000, let's say, okay? Let me use a simple number, $107,000. So 4.5 years have gone by. You go into a nursing home. You apply then. Now you're going to have 10 months. Take that $107,000 divided by $10,700. You're going to have 10 months of ineligibility to get Medicaid when you could have just waited 6 months and applied and you wouldn't have passed the five-year look back. So you actually hurt yourself by applying too early. So there's a lot to the Medicaid planning, but you're correct. There is a look back period, and equally or more importantly, there's a penalty period that can be opposed if there was a gifting done.
Got it. Brian Zenk, our guest today, founder and managing director of Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk wills, medical director directives, and a whole lot more with our guest, Ryan Zenk, director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us today. And questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. John wants to know, is listed as the personal representative in the will of a relative, and wonders what are the steps that he has to go through now that that person has died. I mean, he's got the will, and what do you, how do you proceed?
Sure. So you the will has to get filed with the court, in the probate court in the county in which the individual was residing when they passed, and a petition is made to open up a probate. Most people typically are going to want to hire an attorney that handles probates to handle that. It's not required, but often advised. And once the petition is filed along with the death certificate and the will, the probate judge will issue what's called domiciliary letters to the personal representative. So that's the document, or that's the piece of paper that then gives that individual the right to gather the assets, deal with, you know, whatever the assets happen to be, bank accounts, real estate, whatever it is. So that's the first step, is to petition to open up a probate, file the will, certified death certificate, and the petition with the court, get domiciliary letters issued, and then the probate process starts. And again, there's a number of steps in it, and you can plan on it taking typically about a year. Sometimes it takes significantly longer than that. Depends on the nature of the estate and whether it's challenged and whether you go formal probate or informal probate. But that's the first step.
And probably a good idea to work with an attorney on that.
Generally, it is, Larry, just because it's hard for people to, you know, to know exactly what their steps are.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got some information. We had a veteran call earlier wondering about free wills, and we got an email from Holly in Blanchardville, and she called. She called to say there's a program called Wills for Heroes, and it provides free wills for veterans. So if you type in, anybody could type in Wills for Heroes, and you'll get a link to the service that's provided. So that's pretty good news. Good to hear.
Larry, I have heard of that before, and I think that that's available for first responders as well. And I think that's through the Wisconsin State Bar. So I think that is, in addition to veterans, I think that that's available for first responders also.
Yeah, as I'm actually seeing the website here, it's www.wisbar.org.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole string of four members / pro bono pages / wills for heroes. And so that sounds like a pretty legitimate thing to me, anyway, if you're going through that step.
And the State Bar, the State Bar of Wisconsin, it can be a great resource for folks. If you want to find an attorney in your area that specializes in it doesn't matter if it's estate planning, if your dog bites the neighbor or something, whatever, you can call the State Bar of Wisconsin and get a referral to attorneys that focus in that area. In that area of practice that are located in, you know, proximate to where you live. So that's a, State Bar of Wisconsin is a great resource for folks to use.
Carol in De Pere has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a will that was done about 20 years ago in Illinois, but I'm now a resident in Wisconsin. Do I have to have changes made?
To make it in accordance with Wisconsin law. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, the answer is it depends. You don't necessarily, but you may have to. You definitely would want to have it looked at by an attorney that is Wisconsin licensed and practices in that area. So the answer is not necessarily, but it certainly is possible. And some folks ask that question because it's a different state, or folks ask, you know, say my will is old. Do I have to, you know, do I have to redo it because it was done years ago? And my answer is the same. It depends. So there's a number of things that come into play there, quite frankly. So what you'd want to do is just probably get a complimentary consultation with a law firm that's near you that focuses in that area and have a conversation with them.
Yeah, so maybe an elder law attorney, something like that?
Yeah, or just a traditional estate planning attorney should be
sure.
able to handle a will, because that's relatively simple. What I would suggest you also do, though, is ask whoever you deal with, ask them not only, you know, should I change this, but ask them what your alternatives are. What other options do I have to accomplish my goals of getting it to whoever you want it to go to? Tell me the advantages and disadvantages of my different options, please. Because a lot of people, once they're educated, they find out that maybe a will isn't the way they want to go because, again, it has to go through the court system when you pass away, and part of that money is going to go to the court and to the attorneys that, you know, could have gone to your family members or charities or whoever you're leaving it to, Wisconsin Public Radio, for example, instead of going to, you know, for probate fees. So it's a, you know, I think it's a good idea to also find out what your other options are other than a will, and then ask about the advantages and disadvantages of your options.
Mm-hmm. Good points. Carol, thank you very much for calling. I think this has come up, but again, I can sort of re-ask it. Pete emailed to ask, how does land and or homes held in trust protect the assets from being claimed by a long-term care center? Also, doesn't a house get automatically passed to a spouse because it's marital property in Wisconsin? That kind of relates to an earlier call.
Okay, so two different questions there.
Yeah.
So again, it depends on the trust. If it's a revocable trust, it typically affords no protection. If it's an irrevocable trust, it may protect the asset. And just for the record, there are ways to pass a house without spending money on an irrevocable trust. There are some less expensive ways to pass the house to intended beneficiaries. And have it protected from a nursing home situation. So there are other methods in the state of Wisconsin that you can employ. And then the other question was, doesn't it automatically go to a spouse because Wisconsin's a marital property state? Again, it depends. So a couple can opt out of Wisconsin marital property law. So you can do what's called, if a couple does a marital property opt-out agreement, maybe the house... the spouse doesn't have an interest in the house. You know, maybe there's a prenup that was in place and the house was brought into the marriage by one spouse, and it's their individual property and they have an agreement that it shall remain so. So it depends. Now, the default is, though, that it is marital property and that a spouse has an interest in the house, even if their name isn't on it. So again, there's a lot of nuances to that. You definitely want to talk to an attorney about that. Sometimes people have blended families. I mean, there's a number of issues that can come up with that. So it isn't, you can't make the statement that it's automatically going to go to a spouse. That may very well be the case, but it may not be.
Sandy had emailed to say they've read that if a person leaves their timeshare to a beneficiary in their will, but the beneficiary never claims it, that is, it just goes back to the original company. Sandy looked into it because it seemed like a cruel joke to play on a beneficiary to saddle them with a timeshare.
Generally, that's correct. Generally, you can't force an asset on someone. They have to accept it. Otherwise, you know, think about it. If someone had a property that's contaminated, they could just deed it over to their enemy and their enemy would be stuck with, you know, a cleanup or something. So that's correct. You can't usually force assets on someone. They have to accept them.
Oh, man.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness for that. And Mike emailed to say his in-laws are retired, recently purchased a new house. Mike wants to know what happens if they pass away and more money is owed on the house than it is worth. Who takes on the financial responsibility? It kind of relates in a way.
The answer is the bank is, shucks out of luck, right? Basically, so what would, depending on the nature of the estate or how the property was held, someone would, whoever has the legal authority to do so would probably just sign a deed over back to the bank, or the bank would have to initiate proceedings to foreclose on it. So that's what would happen. The beneficiaries aren't going to be responsible personally for that debt.
Okay. I suppose the bank could go after the assets of the deceased. Or not.
It depends.
Yeah.
It depends. Very often, the only collateral is going to be the real estate itself. But it may be that they have authority to go after other assets as well.
Okay. James and Mellon, your turn. Hi, James. James, are you there? James says his... Have we got James? Here's the...
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Quickly give us your question. We lost him. The caller's grandmother, the will was done on a floppy disk, and they're unable to access it since. What can be done?
It's probably not going to work, but they could try. They can attempt. I mean, find someone that, where you could print it out and try to get it to a judge and have them accept it. But it's highly unlikely.
Yeah,
that the judge is going to accept that a copy of it. And usually, even a copy of a will usually isn't going to suffice. The original is typically necessary. Most judges won't recognize a simple copy. In certain cases, they can, so you could try, but the odds are that it's not going to work.
And there are, I see online, that we can handle your pictures from old, situations. I wonder if there's a company out there. I'd go online and check, can somebody, read a floppy disk?
Yeah, you're correct, Larry. There definitely are companies that will do that.
Oh, man. Well, we've covered a lot in the last 30 seconds. Is there anything you want to say that we haven't talked about?
No, I think it just makes sense for folks to make sure you get something in place, and rather than doing nothing, because like I said, it's inevitable for all of us, and you're going to make it a lot easier for those who come after you in terms of estate planning if you do something ahead of time.
Those are good final words, Ryan. Thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely, Larry.
Ryan Zeg is founder and managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, certified financial planner and attorney, also founder and CEO of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. It's great to have him with us. Probably have him back down the road to talk about this again. And I want to thank you for listening. Thanks to our team for creating our shows every day, our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.